I am very happy now to welcome Karen Armitage. She is the Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health, and she will be speaking tonight. It's part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. It's a lecture titled H1N1, Swine Flu and You, and it's at 6:30 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So H1N1 flu, first of all, what is it and why don't we call it swine flu anymore? Is it the same thing?
You know, I think swine flu is an easy to remember name, but a lot of times common names for diseases become a little untrue. In fact, swine flu has a little bit of the flu virus from pigs and a little bit of the flu virus from birds, and it's a combination of human, bird, and swine flus. But it helps people to communicate if they have a common name for it. The CDC has renamed it H1N1 novel influenza.
H1N1, and I guess they don't really have what you would call professional naming people on their staff.
Apparently not.
But what is different about it? I mean, certainly there's a lot of talk about swine flu or H1N1. How is it different, or is it different from any other flu?
The flu family of viruses has clusters and characteristics associated with them. This is the first time we've seen this particular cluster of this family of flu viruses. But there are many, many different clusters of family flu viruses. In fact, every year, a different cluster of a mix of flu viruses circulate, which is why we have to make a new flu vaccine every year.
Is there a vaccine so far for this cluster?
There is a vaccine. It has been developed. It's been tested, and it's gone through, as you may already know, flu vaccine is developed and tested through a similar system every year. And so the new circulating virus has also been used to produce a new vaccine in the same system, in the same way. But it's unique in that we haven't seen this particular clustering of flu virus components. And so it has a name, and we're making a vaccine against it. I think it's important to remember the way you make the vaccine and the idea of a vaccine is actually not new. It's routine. But it's a new strain of flu virus that we haven't seen in that combination.
When you say combination, is it more than one actual species of virus?
I think it's helpful to think about viruses as being very simple forms of life. They don't have very much inside them. They're basically not able to reproduce by themselves or to grow or to develop. They have to go into a little cell and take over the machinery in order to create more copies of themselves. So H and N refer to two recognizable parts of the virus. And that's how we type them. Like this is H1N1, this is H2N3. That's how we name them, and that's how we prepare a vaccine against them. But they're actually quite simple forms of life. They're exceptionally small. Can't really see them without an electron microscope. And they invade cells, our cells, very much like a germ might infect our body. I mean, they're very, very tiny.
And potentially very dangerous. Who is most vulnerable to the H1N1 virus and to flu in general?
I think we speak of flu in general. We think of folks being most susceptible if they're very young or if they're very senior, over 65, or if they have an underlying health condition that makes it hard for them to fight back, to fight the virus. H1N1 has been a little different in that what we notice is folks that are a little older aren't as likely to be infected.
Interesting. Well, do we know why that is?
The reason that we believe is true, although it'll be interesting to see how this turns out over time, is that the older people are, the more likely they've seen multiple years of flu outbreaks, and the more skilled their immune system is at detecting flu early and mounting response so they don't get it.
But again, that's not true of all flus. It's true of this one in particular.
Well, there is some evidence that having had, for example, let's say that a woman, 60, has had real influenza 4 or 5 times in her life, and those influenza viruses were sort of a mix of types. She has an immune system that's been sort of trained to look for influenza. And that may be the advantage that older people have in this H1N1 outbreak, is that they live longer and their own bodies now recognize flu earlier and they can mount a response and perhaps not be infected.
Is the swine flu H1N1 what you would at this point call an epidemic in the United States, in the world, in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good question. We're referring to it as a pandemic. And pandemics imply that a virus has spread outside a state, outside a country, to separate countries and to other continents. So pandemic really means worldwide. This is a pandemic. It is by definition mild so far. Most people who get it are not terribly sick, but it is a pandemic in that it spread over the world, more or less.
So, first of all, what kind of prevention should people be doing in New Mexico?
Well, as you know, there isn't a widely distributed vaccine for this yet,
right.
Although we do expect to have enough vaccine over the next month or two. We expect to be able to distribute enough vaccine, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to vaccinate most people who want to be vaccinated. But if you think about that, the most protective thing you can do is to wash your hands, take good care of yourself, and stay home if you're sick, so that you don't spread this to others in the workplace or at school.
Washing your hands is so very simple, and it's hard to remember that it's really effective, but washing your hands can be the difference between getting the flu, any kind of flu, and not getting it.
I completely agree. It seems simple to us, and yet it's actually underlies much of the disease we see in the world. Hand washing is a major determinant of disease. Our ability to have clean water and dispose of sewage safely and to have wholesome foods, those are all big predictors of major disease. And we don't see so much of those diseases in the U.S. right now or in developed countries, but there are still major problems with those diseases in some parts of the world that are based on basic sanitation.
At the same time, and I don't want to contradict what we're saying about washing your hands, people can go overboard in sanitizing everything and practically getting an autoclave to wash your dishes and things like that.
Well, clean enough might be a good way to put it. Let's be clean enough. I think washing your hands with ordinary soap and water is a great way to reduce your risk of getting the flu.
And for example, you don't need antibacterial soap.
It doesn't seem to make much difference in the transmission of disease. Now, the hand alcohol hand rubs are a little different. They're not really a soap. They're just a treatment for your skin if you can't wash with soap and water. And they do seem to reduce transmission of flu virus.
We're talking to Karen Armitage, Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. So what is the situation in New Mexico? How many people have had H1N1 flu? How many people have died from it? What are you seeing?
That's a very good question. As you may have already figured out, since most people who get this infection are mildly ill, not ill enough perhaps even to go to the doctor, we don't really know how many cases we've had. What we can count is how many people are hospitalized and how many people die. At this time in New Mexico, we've had a dozen people who've died of H1N1 infection, and many more dozens of people who've been hospitalized. But we've had many, many reports of what we call influenza-like illness. We refer to that as ILI. Influenza-like illness is monitored by a few doctors and clinics all over the state. They monitor all the time, year-round. And if they see a case of influenza-like illness, they test it for us. So we look at those rates of influenza-like illness, and what we're seeing in those surveillance sites and also in doctors' offices and hospitals is more people have this infection than they did last week or the week before that. So we're looking at rising numbers of influenza-like illness, and almost all of that is believed to be due at this time to H1N1 influenza.
It seems also that people are getting the flu earlier in the season than they usually do.
You are exactly right. As someone who works in public health all the time, I'm used to seeing flu peak sometime in January or maybe February or in an early year, December. You'll recall that this new flu version showed up in March. We have some sense that it never really left, that it's sort of been hanging around, and we're now seeing a peak as it's spread through a larger number of people. But you're right, it's an early flu season for us. I think it's important for listeners to know we actually expect the normal flu may return in its normal time, maybe in December or January. And that's why it's important for folks to consider getting regular old flu shot. And also, when H1N1 flu shot is available, we hope they'll consider getting that shot too.
So those are two different things, and they won't don't overlap in how they work. The H1N1 vaccine will only work against H1N1, and the regular flu shot will only work against the regular flu.
In general, I think it's interesting to think about flu vaccine as being something that must be made every year. You know, normally if you think about a vaccine, like a vaccine against, say, tetanus or a vaccine against measles, you don't have to remake those. It's stable. The special thing about the flu vaccine is it's able to change very quickly, so quickly that if you had the flu last year, you might still get the flu next year if it's a different family of strains, a cluster of specific flu viruses. So every year they make a new vaccine, and right now they've made a new vaccine for the widely circulating H1N1. Virus.
The people who have had H1N1 who have been hospitalized or who have died of it, are they mostly or all people with those specific vulnerabilities that you were talking about earlier?
Most of them had some pre-existing condition, or they have another risk factor, like their age or their condition that they have. But there have been very otherwise healthy people, and that's actually not so unusual either. Every year, influenza does make some very healthy people sick enough that they're hospitalized, and we do have folks who die of flu each year, even though we wouldn't have predicted it. Most folks who get very sick with the flu have what you talked about. They either are at risk because of age, or they have an underlying medical condition or health condition that makes it harder for them to recover.
When was the great flu epidemic of the 20th century?
Most people refer to the pandemic of 1917, 1918. Estimates at the time were 21 million people died worldwide. There have been estimates that it may have been higher. As you might expect, we weren't as careful or as good at counting specific kinds of death because this was early in the 20th century. But I wanted... I think it's good that you raised that, because that was an example of a pandemic flu that was very serious and made a lot of people very sick.
A lot of people died of the flu at that time.
Yes, and it wasn't what I would consider mild, but it started out as mild. And that's why we're very interested in stopping this pandemic as soon as we can, by asking folks to prevent the disease if they can, and by encouraging folks to get a vaccination.
I was reading the CDC website, Centers for Disease Control, which is very easy to access. If you have a computer and you just Google CDC, it'll come right up. Some people are doing swine flu parties, which is that they're getting one person who's infected to come to a party and infect everybody else. Not a good idea.
You know, not from a public health physician's perspective, no. There were chickenpox parties 30 or 40 years ago. Some of your listeners may remember that too. When you see that occasionally a mild disease leads to a very serious illness or even death, it keeps you from thinking the idea of a flu party is a good idea. You certainly wouldn't want to look back on it and say, we intentionally did this, and some of these folks had a very poor outcome. But you can understand why families might think about that. They'd like for their children to become immune to the flu. We're suggesting that families have their kids vaccinated against the flu.
So what are the symptoms of it that maybe are not the same as other flu symptoms? Or is it just the same?
You know, we talked about, you and I talked a little bit before we came on the air about how different flus might be, and that each flu variant might be quite different. One of the things that's been noticed about this flu variant is that the incubation period seems to be quite short. People go from not being sick to being sick in a relatively short period of time, just a day or two. Sometimes it takes longer for people to get a traditional seasonal flu.
So in a traditional flu, you might sneeze on me, and 2 weeks later I get the flu.
Well, you know, I tend to think of the incubation window as being a little wider, a little longer, and so maybe you'd get sick on the third day or the fourth day. But this flu, people seem to become ill or have symptoms pretty quickly.
So within a day or two?
Within a day or two.
Ah.
So that's helpful for people to know. If you were with somebody who was sick and you're perfectly well 3 or 4 days later, you're probably not going to get sick from that contact with someone who has the flu. Other differences have to do with this flu seems to be more contagious to young people. And we think that may be because folks who've seen many flu seasons have a little more resistance to this currently circulating flu. So that's another difference.
So the symptoms of it are headache, fever, body aches, sneezing, sniffling, mm-hmm. but also some people have nausea and vomiting.
They do. And if you think about it, some people feel so ill and their bodies respond so strongly that nausea and vomiting may be a part of that. Also, the flu virus can infect all cell lines in the body, and so that may be a presentation. That may be why people get nausea and vomiting. Not always, but some.
So once you've got the flu, if you want to know if it's H1N1, how can you find out?
Well, this is going to sound funny, but the simple answer is we're almost certain you do have H1N1 if you get flu symptoms, and that's because there aren't any other circulating flu types of any number. So if people have what we call classic influenza-like illness, it's overwhelmingly likely that they have H1N1. I think that would be important to know. It would save you having to have a test done. It would save you having to talk with the doctor. Do you think I have this type of flu? But it may be harder for folks to decide, do I have just a regular cold or do I really have the flu?
So how should they treat themselves or have their families or friends or whatever treat them if they start to come down with these symptoms?
I recommend that people play it safe. Assume that you might have the flu if you begin to get sick, and then pay attention to your symptoms. Most people who have the flu get a fever. Not all, but most. So if you have a way to measure your temperature, and your temperature is 100 degrees or more, it's more likely, if you have also a sore throat or a cough, that you actually have the flu. Folks may also want to think about how sick they feel. This is a mild flu. But most folks say that they feel tired and that they need to go to bed. If you think about a common cold, people go right on with whatever they're doing. They walk their dog, they go to work. It's not something that makes them stop and lie down for a day or two. So I think that's another way to be more suspicious that you might have the flu, is that you feel much sicker than you would with, say, a normal cold or with allergies if you have them.
So you go to bed and what? Drink chicken soup?
You know, it sounds funny, but certainly rest, liquids, and just supportive care make people feel much better. I also think it's important to remember that your immune system is what's going to take care of this disease. And your immune system works better if you're rested, if you have plenty of fluids, and if you're eating healthy foods.
Are there any drugs or medications or even over-the-counter stuff that really combat it better, that help your own immune system to combat it?
There is a certain class of drugs. We call them antivirals. They basically slow the virus's ability to make copies of itself, which is how it creates all this mayhem. And those antiviral drugs, can slow the virus down enough for your immune system to take over and clean it up. We're only using antiviral drugs in serious cases because these drugs are the flu is very good at learning to manage these medicines, so we use them only when we think they'll make a difference. So, for example, if you have the flu and you're in the hospital, someone will give you antiviral medicines to help your immune system get a hold on the flu and get over it. If you're someone who has a risk factor, like let's say you have a serious underlying medical condition like diabetes or serious asthma, those folks, if they get the flu, should take antivirals because they're more likely to have a serious problem.
How do you know when you should go to the hospital?
That's a very good question. There are some warning signs that you may want to consider. I'll talk first about warning signs for adults. If adults who have what they think is the flu experience difficulty breathing, or a shortness of breath, not able to get your breath. If they feel a great deal of pain in their chest or their abdomen, if they feel a sort of dizzy, or their family describes them as being confused, or if they are not able to hold liquids down or stop vomiting for a period of a day or so, it's good for them to get an evaluation, and they may need to be hospitalized in order to get better.
There is treatment of disease, and then there is also treatment of fear of the disease. You, before we went on the air, you were calling it hysteria.
Yeah.
And that's, in a way, harder to treat.
I think it's very hard for folks to know what to do when they feel very worried about the flu, because right now we're just starting to get the vaccine. So I think sometimes we are very, very frightened of this disease, and we may or may not make good decisions while we're very frightened. I always encourage people to stick to the facts, get a good, solid piece of advice from an agency like the CDC or the Department of Health, and then get some help with this real fear. There are several places people can call and talk about the flu or ask questions about the flu, and I really encourage folks, if they're computer types, to learn as much as they can by pulling up excellent websites. I think it's important to remember that our best decisions are based on evidence or facts. And while we may feel very frightened, it's still important to make good decisions based on evidence and facts.
What numbers can they call, and what websites should they look at?
Let me give you a couple of websites that I think have a section for the public and a section for different groups like parents, kids, and other groups. That website is cdc.gov.
cdc.gov.
There you go, cdc.gov. There's also a phone number you can call if you have a concern about H1N1 and you'd like to talk with someone. That number is 1-800-CDC-INFO. Info, CDC Info.
1-800-CDC-INFO, whatever that translates into numbers.
And I'll actually give you that number because I think that can be sort of frustrating for folks. That number is 1-800-232-4636.
Excellent. So people can actually talk to a person and say, mm-hmm. I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, and get some decent advice.
Or learn more about, is there a flu vaccine in my neighborhood? What should I worry about with my child? There is another number that folks can call here in New Mexico and talk with a registered nurse.
Mm-hmm.
This is best for folks who might have symptoms of flu and want to discuss it and need more information. That number is 1-877-725-2552.
Excellent. And 877, that's a toll-free number, 725-2552. And by the way, if you're a computer type, this show will be podcast starting shortly after the show is over, so you can always listen to it again and get all that information. So you are the chief medical officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. What is the mood like around the Department of Health? Are people worried about this? Is it just yet another thing you guys are used to it because you're public health officers?
You know, we're actually used to flu season every year, but this is a special one for us because it essentially has required us to double all of our efforts. There are two flus that we expect may circulate, and this flu came early for us, and we didn't have a vaccine. So I think I would describe the environment at the Department of Health is very, very busy right now.
Your tax dollars at work.
That's right.
In a good way.
In a good way.
So what about face masks? Do you recommend, I mean, there are some people who work in public, I've seen in airports and post office and things like that. Is it a good thing to wear a face mask?
You know, the data about how much face masks work isn't very good. They're relatively uncomfortable to wear. They get saturated with moisture because we breathe through them. People take them off and put them on sometimes based on their perception of risk, but that may or may not be where they're at most risk. So what we're advising is if you're a healthcare provider in an environment, that you follow the CDC guidelines for the use of face masks. And if you're a member of the public, certainly if you're following all the other requirements, hand washing, getting a vaccine, staying home if you're sick, covering your cough and sneeze with a tissue and washing your hands.
And then throwing the tissue out.
Throwing it out and actually washing your hands. I have to tell you that I heard a child describe the new technique of coughing into the crook of your arm as the Dracula cough, which I thought was very funny when they throw their arm up. So
that's funny.
The Dracula cough.
Right, yeah. Right. Karen Armitage is the Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. Anything else you want to let people know about H1N1 swine flu?
I hope that folks will continue to seek out vaccine when it comes to their community and will get a vaccination to protect themselves and the ones they love. We'd love for them to contact us at the Department of Health, and you can also go to our website to find out specifically what New Mexico is doing and what new developments there are in H1N1 flu here in our state. And that website is health.state.nm.us.
And I bet if you Google New Mexico Department of Health, you'll get it just as quick.
It's right. It'll pop right up.
Any phone numbers?
Well, we have several phone numbers that have to do with needing to get more information about certain virus, certain medications, or needing to report disease. But most of our phone number access is for providers and clinics. But what folks can do is at the website, the health department website, there are alternatives for contacting us in other ways, sending us an email, giving us a call on a general line. There are also some lines that have just information. There's not a person that answers the phone. And those numbers are also on the website.
On the website. Karen Armitage will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science lecture series. It's at 6 o'clock tonight at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for helping us get the message out about H1N1 influenza.
And the Santa Fe Alliance for Science can be found on the web at SFAFS, as in Santa Fe Alliance for Science, .org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at KSFR.org. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and my website, which is a podcast site where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, is santafe.radiocafe.org. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.